Welcome to the AFP Report. This is your host, John Friend. Today is Monday, March 6th, 2023. This is the 35th edition of the AFP Report, a podcast series where I will be interviewing reporters and contributors to American Free Press, America's last real newspaper, as well as other special guests. Please consider subscribing to American Free Press if you are not already. Subscription details can be found at AmericanFreePress.net. Today, I'm joined by Phil Giraldi, a regular contributor to the newspaper and a leading expert on U.S. foreign policy. All right, Phil Giraldi, welcome back to the program, sir. How are you today?
I'm fine. How are you doing, John?
I'm good. I'm doing just fine. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me once again. It's always great to catch up with you. You are, of course, a regular columnist for American Free Press and one of America's leading foreign policy experts and geopolitical analysts. You are also a regular contributor to the UNS Review, which is one of the leading independent media outlets on the internet. And we just wrapped up issue 9 and 10 of American Free Press late last week. It is currently at the printer and is going to be mailed out to all subscribers this week. So if you are not already subscribing to the newspaper, now is your time to do so. Check out AmericanFreePress.net for subscription details and information. And Phil, I do want to talk about your article that was published in issue 9 and 10, which is the most recent issue. But first, I want to ask you about your article that was published in the previous issue, which is 7 and 8, which subscribers should have already received by now. I know I received my copy a little over a week ago. And your article in issue 7 and 8 summarized and assessed Seymour Hersh's lengthy investigative report detailing the Biden administration's leading role in the industrial sabotage of the Nord Stream pipelines last fall. And I think anyone who has honestly looked at that situation would have to conclude that the U.S. played a leading role in this international act of terrorism on the Nord Stream pipelines. In early February of 2022, just before the Russian special military operation against Ukraine, President Biden himself basically said that the U.S. would destroy the pipelines in Russia, you know, if Russia were to invade. And then, of course, we had Secretary of State Antony Blinken, a leading neocon operative in the Biden administration. He called this act of terrorism very significant and a tremendous strategic opportunity for the U.S. to fill the role that Russia played in providing energy to Europe. And then, of course, we had Undersecretary of State Victoria Nuland, yet another leading neocon that is controlling U.S. foreign policy and controlling the Biden administration. She told a Senate committee in January, so just a couple months ago, that the Biden administration is very gratified to know that Nord Stream 2 is now a hunk of metal at the bottom of the sea. So very revealing comments from some leading Biden administration officials, including the president himself. So I guess when you look at who had the means, the motive, and certainly who benefited from the Nord Stream pipeline sabotage, and you know, really what it is an act of industrial terrorism, there's just no doubt about it that the U.S. played a leading role and certainly stood to benefit. So, Phil, what do you think? What is your assessment of Seymour Hersh's bombshell report?
Well, basically, you outlined the story quite well. And Seymour Hersh clearly had or continues to have sources inside the administration. I would suspect that the sources are located in the Central Intelligence Agency and probably also in the Pentagon. My suspicion is based on the fact that in the past I've worked with Seymour Hersh after I had left the agency and I was working for private security companies. I'd frequently have lunch with Seymour, and he would go over what stories he was working on and how he was corroborating information. This is a guy who never goes with a single source to write an expose like this one about the pipelines. He has multiple sources, and the multiple sources basically are people who corroborate the information that he's providing. I think that this story that his story came out on February 8th, about a month ago, and it basically it puts all the pieces together. It explains how the United States had the motive, how the president basically said if there were a Russian intervention in Ukraine, we would stop the pipeline. And that's exactly what we did. He even admitted it. And then Hirsch, for his part, pulled together all the discussions that took place before the actual destruction of the pipeline took place, and how it was implemented. He had details in terms of how the explosives were put into place under cover of a NATO exercise, and then how they were exploded with a timer to enable the people setting them off to get out of the way and get safe. So he had all the details. To me, as far as I'm concerned, the story might not be 100% because people sometimes forget things or they perceive things differently, but it's damn close to 100.
Yeah, exactly. And certainly if you look at, you know, who stood to benefit from this, you know, who was basically signaling that they were going to do something like this if Russia were to invade. I mean, as I said, you know, the president himself was basically threatening to sabotage the pipelines, you know, should Russia invade. And that's sounds like basically what happened. The article that Hirsch wrote is very, very long and very detailed. And has all the all the background details, all the information that you need. And I would encourage people to go out and check it out if they haven't read it already. I think he makes, frankly, a very persuasive case that it was in fact, you know, the Biden administration that played a leading role in carrying out this act of terrorism. I'm curious, what was your reaction to the mass media's coverage or lack thereof, I should say, of this very bombshell report? I mean, there was virtual silence essentially, right?
Yeah, the virtual silence is right. When you consider that this was an act of war, and which well could be packaged as an act of terrorism, as you've described it, and it basically involved an act of war or terror against an American ally, Germany. Germany was not in the loop, apparently, on this decision making, and Germany was the recipient and the receiving end of the pipeline. And it also, of course, was an act of war against Russia, which the United States was not at and is not at war with. So this is an act of war very clearly. And considering that, I only saw in the mainstream media two very small articles about the Hirsch finding. One was in the Wall Street Journal that came out shortly thereafter, after Hirsch submitted his report. And the other one was in the Washington Post, and it was about six lines long. That's basically it. So the mainstream media would not pick up on this, even given the immense importance of what took place. You know, act of war against a major nuclear power, Russia, an act of war against, or terrorism against the major U.S. ally in Europe, Germany. So, I mean, this is incredible. Just as you put it, pretty much close to silence.
Yeah, it's very interesting, and I think it's very revealing about the state of the media in the wider Western world today. When we have a person like Seymour Hirsch, who's easily one of the most reputable journalists, probably in American history. I mean, he ranks up there among the top journalists in all of American history, and he's publishing bombshell reports like this on his own Substack page, rather than in the pages of the New York Times or the Washington Post or the New Yorker. I know he's in the past written for The New Yorker, you know, some very bombshell reports in that publication. But now he's reduced to his own Substack page. I mean, the mainstream mass media won't even touch this story.
Yeah, that's exactly correct. I mean, they didn't want to touch this story because this goes against their presumptions about Russia being the heart of evil. And everything that preceded that in Ukraine with U.S. Interference and so on and so forth is irrelevant. They act like all of a sudden the Russians woke up some morning and decided to attack Ukraine. And you and I know the story is a whole lot more complicated than that. And the people in the media know that, too. But they are more interested in pushing an agenda now. And this is a frightful turn of events because once upon a time, back in Vietnam, back when I was drafted, the media could be relied upon to publish stories that the government did not want to see about the Vietnam War in particular. And that was a different media in those days. And now we have a media that's basically sold out and is dependent on the U.S. government for a lot of its source information, so it doesn't want to rock the boat. And it's quite scary. We have to go to alternative media to find out what's going on.
Yeah, absolutely. Did you see? I'm curious. Did you see the interview that he did, that Seymour Hersh did with Democracy Now, and how YouTube had basically censored the interview to a certain extent? I think they've restored it now, but you know, this was a very powerful interview that was going viral basically, and then YouTube put like a content warning on it, and was basically trying to prevent this video from going viral and reaching more and more people. Did you see that? I don't know if that's something that you came across. I thought that was very revealing aspect of all this, that, you know, major social media platforms like YouTube are literally censoring the story.
Yeah, no, that you're absolutely correct. I did in fact see the interview, but I also saw the interview starting right from when it appeared. And I saw what went on with YouTube and also other social media sites like Facebook, where there was instant censorship of the story and an attempt made to say that this is not verifiable, or this is a propaganda. That's the message they were trying to get out there. And it was frightening. They did eventually go back after there were probably thousands, maybe tens of thousands of protests from people like us. And they did indeed finally go back, and they allowed it to be, you could go in and see it after they fixed it the second time around.
Yeah, but still, the fact that they're out there shutting down this sort of information is very, very revealing, I think. Well, you know, in the aftermath, Russia has, of course, demanded an impartial investigation into this act of terrorism on the Nord Stream pipelines. I've seen calls to have this investigation led by the United Nations. What options do the Russians have to hold those responsible for this outrageous act of terrorism accountable? I mean, do you have any faith in a UN investigation? I mean, what options do the Russians have?
Well, that's an interesting story in and of itself. Obviously, the Russians felt it was legitimate for them to call, demand, basically, an investigation by the UN Security Council to see if the details provided by Cy Hersh in his article could be confirmed. The U.S., of course, is going to use, or did use, its veto to make sure that no such thing was going to happen. So that was kind of the end of that route. Another plausible route is the International Criminal Court, since this was a criminal act by any way you want to cut it. But the U.S. does not recognize the ICC, largely because they do so as to be in a position to protect Israel and the United States from their various meddlings in the Middle East. So this is there's a deliberate thing here with the ICC, and the ICC will be able to take the case, but the U.S. will not be involved. The U.S. will say, "Well, we weren't able to defend ourselves." So this is not true. The third investigation going on is being conducted by the governments of Sweden and Denmark, which were the closest ones to where the pipelines were bombed. And from what I've gathered is that although both these governments claim that they are doing an investigation of the physical evidence of what happened, neither one of them has actually even sent anybody, a diver or anything like that, down to the bottom to see what was there.
Interesting. Yeah. Was it Norway or Denmark that was the other country that was involved with the U.S.? I'm actually trying to pull up Seymour Hersh's article right now. I can't recall because it was one other country that was involved, right?
It's Norway.
It was Norway, yeah.
The Norwegians have a very specific capability. They have a very small navy, obviously, but they have a great capability in deep sea diving and that sort of thing, because they have most of their economy is dependent on their oil production, which is in offshore platforms. So they've developed this special capability. And these divers were, according to Hersh, among those personnel, including Navy divers and probably CIA divers also, who were the ones who implanted the explosives. and then were also played a role in the timers and the detonation of the explosives afterwards.
Right. Yeah. It's and what kills me is, you know, we have all this information, all this evidence pointing to the Biden administration and, you know, working with a country like Norway, for example, being behind this. And, you know, what is Germany doing? What are these other European countries doing? You know, you would think that they would be outraged that, you know, this act of terrorism that was committed against them that totally sabotaged this pipeline. I mean, Russia was supplying massive amounts of energy resources to the Germans and also, you know, to other parts of Europe. And for this just to go uninvestigated, uncommented upon even. I mean, the German government really hasn't even said much about this, have they?
Hardly anything. Stoltz, the chancellor, was in Washington earlier this week, or actually was the end of last week, and the subject hardly came up. I mean, it was basically it was softballed, and he met with Biden, and they apparently, if they talked about it at all, it was done off the record. So that's the other thing. And the other thing that Hirschstedt did not have in his report, which I found rather interesting, and probably you would also, was that the then Prime Minister of Britain, what's her name? Truss.
Liz Truss, yeah.
Truss. Apparently, when the explosion took place, like 1 minute after the explosion that destroyed the pipeline, she called Tony Blinken and said, "Hey, it's done."
Yeah, I saw reports about that. Yeah, boy, that's.
And so apparently the British obviously had a hand in it too. But that may have been the extent of it. It was not certainly it was not presented to the Germans because this deed has had a devastating effect on their economy. They had relatively cheap Russian gas that was basically supporting their industrial economy, and now they're going to be gifted with liquid LPG from the United States, which costs twice as much.
Yeah, exactly. It's man, it's just outrageous. Now, the pipeline itself, I believe it's mostly owned by Gazprom, which is a Russian state-owned gas company. But there's also other players involved, right? I think it's a French firm and a German firm and maybe even a Dutch firm, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. So there's other people involved, you know, in financing this pipeline. I mean, wouldn't you think that they would be outraged? I mean, you know, this is a huge investment, obviously, and had a lot of potential to make these companies a lot of money. And still, you don't hear anything about it. I mean, it's pretty revealing, I think.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. 51% of the pipelines are owned by Gazprom, which is a Russian company. And that means that Russia has ultimately majority control. But the other 49% is owned by, as you said, German, French, Dutch, I believe were the three companies that were cited. Now, these companies are companies in a sense, but they also have a big stake from their own governments in their operation and in their investment and that kind of thing. So this is, I think, clearly a case where the governments are putting pressure on the companies who took a big loss in this. To keep quiet about it.
Yeah, that certainly appears to be the case. Well, we'll see what happens. I mean, I don't know a good way to say this, but you know, I think the Russians should do what they need to do to make sure that this doesn't happen again and to hold the people accountable, responsible. I don't know exactly how that's going to play out, but I mean, this is a pretty outrageous act, and I think all the evidence leads to it being done by the U.S., by the Biden administration, working with its quote-unquote allies, you know, maybe Norway, maybe other countries were involved. You talked about the UK and Liz Truss. I'm sure that they were at least in the know. I don't know what sort of operational role that they played, but this is just outrageous, you know, what happened, and I guess we'll see how it's going to play out. But it looks like Russia on the battlefront, you know, Russia is firmly in control, and you know, it's going to be interesting to see how this sort of winds down. If it does, I think the U.S. strategy is to prolong this conflict as long as possible, and just to, you know, sort of grind Russia down. But it's just a tragedy, totally unnecessary as well. And so yeah, I'm sure there's going to be some more developments, you know, in the weeks and months ahead. But I know we only got about 10 more minutes left, and I want to also talk about your most recently published article in issue 9 and 10, which, as I mentioned previously, is currently being printed as we speak. It's going to be mailed out this week. And you know, for the past 5 years or so, we've heard all about alleged Russian interference in U.S. elections. But the reality is that the U.S. government and Israeli tech companies connected to the Israeli government and military play the leading roles in subverting governments and interfering in elections around the world, which is the subject of your most recent article. You want to talk about your most recent article quick?
Sure, real quick. I talk about a trip to Eastern Europe made by Samantha Power, who's the head of USAID. Now, USAID was created in 1961 to help the developing democracies in Europe and other places, but it has long since abandoned that role and is basically doing the sorts of things that the CIA used to do in the 1950s and 60s. They're basically involved in regime change, in setting up NGOs in these various countries that will in turn put pressure on the local governments and put pressure on the electorates to change the parties that are running the countries. So this is what the USAID is all about. She made a trip to Hungary, and six other Eastern European countries are apparently are also on the travel list. I don't know if she's gone to them yet, but she basically is setting up institutions without any reference or discussions with the local government. She's just coming in and saying, yeah, the U.S. government is going to set these things up through the embassies, and this is what we're going to do. And it's very interesting to watch the process, because they're focusing on countries like Hungary, which has Viktor Orban as head of state, who is not liked much by the United States because he's against this war in Ukraine, among other things. So this whole thing will be an exercise in setting up NGOs and press outlets and stuff like that to get rid of Viktor Orban and bring in a government closer to the U.S. So I'm saying, when I talk about regime change, well, we did it in Ukraine back in 2014, and we see the result that we've come up with that. And they're trying to do it again and again and again.
Yes. You know, one thing I wanted to bring up real quickly is, and you talk about this in the article, is who she actually met with when she was in Hungary. She met with political opposition, you know, the political, I don't know if it was political parties or just opposition political figures, but also LGBTQ groups. And that's, you know, a big part of some of the rhetoric that we heard from her. And that's something that Hungary has taken a very strong stand against. And that is something that is very upsetting to these degenerates in Washington, D.C., who seem to prioritize promoting homosexual marriage and that sort of lifestyle around the entire world.
Yeah. Very interestingly, when she tweeted some of the results of her visit, and it was very clear that she was prioritizing LGBTQ groups and setting up mechanisms for them to put pressure on the government. The government, for example, is against preaching or teaching about homosexuality or promoting homosexuality in the grade schools, in the state schools in Hungary. And this, of course, is something that runs against what the Biden administration believes in. So this is what is going to where the pressure, among other pressures, is going to be coming from. Mm-hmm. I think I entitled the article something like that: Do we have a woke foreign policy? Well, I think the answer is yes.
Yeah. And isn't it also sort of like revealing and just an insult to the Hungarian government that the U.S. would appoint this ambassador, David Pressman, who's a Jewish homosexual? He's the ambassador to Hungary from the U.S. You know, I mean, to me, that's just like a poke in the eye to the Hungarian government, you know, to appoint a guy like this who's very flamboyant and very, you know, makes it known, you know, he's homosexual and, you know, cares very much about those issues. It's just, you know, another example of U.S. meddling in the you know, the internal politics of a foreign country.
Well, I agree. I mean, and this Pressman is married to another man and has two adopted children, both boys. And he flaunts his homosexuality in a country where there are religious and moral issues about homosexuality. And this is total ignorance on the part of the Biden administration to send an ambassador to a country that's a friendly country and that you want to have good relations with, and to kind of throw this at them. But, you know, this is the stuff that they do.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Well, and again, it's another move by these sort of deep state forces to just undermine and interfere in the politics of a foreign country. So that's the way the United States does it. Israel has a little bit different strategy. They use some of these tech companies, right, that are deeply connected to the Israeli military and the Israeli government that are basically on hire to interfere with elections overseas. And there was a very revealing expose published by The Guardian. I know the UK Daily Mail was also involved, and there was a couple other European news outlets where they investigated this guy named Tal Hanan, who you also wrote about in this piece. He is the head of what they call Team George, and it's like this team, this tech team, surrounded, you know, organized by this Tal Hanan guy, who's a former Israeli special forces guy. And they're basically on hire to undermine and influence elections around the world. They can hack into people's email accounts. They can manipulate social media and public opinion polls and stuff like that. So you want to briefly just kind of mention this aspect of the story, and then we can go ahead and wrap up.
Yeah, no, it's well, first of all, it's called Team Jorge. It's the Spanish pronunciation, I think.
Oh, yeah. I know you're right.
I'm not sure why. But anyway, yeah, I mean, this guy boasts, he operates out of Tel Aviv. It's a company, and there are several other Israeli companies, as you mentioned, that are in the same business. They essentially are guns for hire on the internet. You pay them $10 million to $15 million, and they will go in and destabilize your election. And how they do it basically is, as you say, they crack into emails, they distribute emails that are embarrassing. They will create what they refer to as false personas or avatars, however you want to refer to them. These are fake identities. They can churn these fake identities out thousands at a time, apparently. They have the software and everything to do this. And they then use these fake identities to flood social media. In other words, if say someone is running against the government party in a country, and this someone in this party want to bring about regime change, they go to these Israelis. The Israelis fake up all this social media stuff that's constantly attacking the government and attacking the party in power, and the new guys get elected. This guy boasts that his company's been doing this for 20 years, that they've interfered in, they've been paid by parties in opposition in these countries to interfere in the election. They've done it 33 times, and 27 times out of the 33, their efforts were successful. The guys who paid them managed to throw the existing government out and get elected. So this is very effective stuff. They do it in the open. They don't seem to care about it. They apparently are also operating in the United States, although they haven't confessed exactly what they've done. But it's, you know, the Russians get accused for interfering in the American election. They did practically nothing, or in fact, almost nothing. And now we got the Israelis, as usual, up to their tricks. And nobody says a word. This story was hardly followed up on in the U.S. media again.
I was just searching right now. I haven't seen any coverage of it in the U.S. media. I mean, The Guardian, to its credit, and the Daily Mail and some other you know, European papers did cover it in great detail, actually. They did a really good job investigating this story. But this is just something you would not even see in the American media.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it really hasn't surfaced. I mean, you know, because there's, of course, that rule in the U.S. media, thou shalt not say anything negative about Israel.
Exactly.
We know that's part of it. But, you know, Jesus, I mean, if you're really concerned about interfering in elections and the impact that this has on world politics and on U.S. foreign policy, this would be something we should be talking about.
Absolutely. Well, Phil, thanks a lot, man. I appreciate you taking the time to speak with me once again. Keep up the great work for American Free Press. And you can also find a lot of your writings over at UNS.com. That's the UNS Review, one of the top independent media platforms on the internet. So, Phil, thanks, man. I appreciate it. Keep up the good work, and we will talk again soon.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for having me on.
Okay. Thank you.